Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+, simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
The issue, though, is that inflation requires some new physics beyond the four fundamental forces that we know about. In particular, this measurement suggests that inflation may have had something to do with unification of the strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces, ideas that particle theorists have been entertaining since the 1970s. So, this detection is cosmology's missing link. It's something that we thought should be there, but we weren't really sure, and it has been eagerly sought now for close to two decades. This is not something that's just a home run, but a grand slam.
That's Mark Hamankowski, professor of physics and astronomy at Johns Hopkins University, part of a team that is reporting a breakthrough in the Big Bang Theory. In fact, a part of the theory that occurs very early, they say, in the life of the universe after the Big Bang, a period called inflation. Now, I know this is all rather confusing. I find it perpetually confusing. What does he mean when he says that this isn't just a home run, this is a grand slam, the missing link in cosmology? Joining us to talk about this reported breakthrough in the Big Bang Theory and a little bit later, a continuing review, Episode 2 of Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey, Dr. Danny Faulkner. He holds a PhD in astronomy from Indiana University, and he's professor of astronomy for Answers in Genesis. He's author of an article titled Big Bang, the Evolution of a Theory. Dr. Faulkner, welcome back.
Thank you.
What does he mean when he says this isn't just a home run, this is the missing link of cosmology, this is a grand slam?
Well, I think it's a bit of oversell to tell you the truth, but inflation is a very important concept. The Big Bang model really needs inflation very badly. Inflation was kind of cooked up or proposed back more than 30 years ago in 1982, and it was put forth to explain two very perplexing problems in cosmology, the Big Bang cosmology. And for the next 30 years, there was absolutely no evidence for it, but very quickly, cosmologists became convinced it was true. The universe had to have it. The reason being, not because of any evidence, but because the Big Bang absolutely positively needed that in order to explain things in the universe. And it's kind of a free parameter. There are several of those in the Big Bang model. So once they decided it was true, it became one of those things they could manipulate to make the model work. So the stakes are big. People are talking about a Nobel Prize in physics coming for the work in this. But inflation was something. They've got several experiments going on right now in Antarctica. This is one of them. And I think there's a rush to try to be the first to declare that you've found this evidence for inflation. And it's a little premature. I've read through the paper that was released yesterday, it's a very statistical argument. It has lots of caveats and stuff, and I think it's a bit premature, to tell you the truth.
Okay, so explain the context to us here, because you say inflation is part of a bigger theory, the theory of the so-called Big Bang, is kind of a stopgap measure. Theorized about in order to explain inconsistencies in what they were finding, their discoveries, after they started pursuing the origins of the universe in the Big Bang. So can you walk us through, you do it in your article beautifully, but can you walk us through kind of where the Big Bang Theory came from and why these various stopgap measures had to be invented in order to prop up the theory, and in particular where inflation fits in all that?
Okay, so the Big Bang is this idea that the universe began suddenly. Now they're saying 13.8 billion years ago, but that date's changed over the years. But the universe appeared suddenly. It was very hot, very dense, but was it expanding as soon as it came into existence? And it supposedly expanded out to what we have today and in the universe, cooling the entire time. And this is the Big Bang model that I grew up with, but by the early 80s, I became aware of this problem called the horizon problem. If you look off in one direction, by the way, the back up a second. They've found the cosmic microwave background, published in 1965. That's, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of this. And there's this microwave radiation coming from every direction in space. It's kind of feeble, but it's there, and it's permeating space. And this was something the Big Bang model had predicted. The steady-state model, which is this eternal universe idea, both expanding. That was something that Edwin Hubble discovered in 1929. The universe is expanding, but the two competing models soon developed. One's eternal, that the universe has always existed, always expanded. The other one, that it began in some instant we call the Big Bang. The steady-state theory could not predict the background radiation. So when they discovered this, background radiation in 65, that just kind of made one game in town, the Big Bang theory. But the problem is, if you look in one direction in space and measure the temperature of the background radiation, and then look in another direction, say the opposite direction from where you first looked, you see pretty much precisely the same temperature. And that's remarkable when you think about it, because in order for things to come to the same temperature, they have to be able to exchange heat somehow. And yet these two different points in the directions in space could have never been in contact to do that. And the same is true of any two directions you want to pick in space. So they dreamed up this idea 30 years ago that maybe early in the universe, and we're talking like a trillion, trillion, trillionth of a second after the universe began, it went through this very rapid expansion, far faster than the speed of light. So the universe went from something very tiny to something maybe millions of light years across, instantly almost. And this kind of allowed the universe to be in thermal contact, so it came to the same temperature, and then it was yanked out of thermal contact, but preserved that same temperature throughout. And it solved another problem they call the flatness problem as well, dealing with sort of the geometry of the universe. So that's kind of the background on this. Now, how would you go about seeing it? Well, the background radiation can be polarized. What I mean by that is any radiation is made of a wave, and usually the waves are moving in every possible direction, but sometimes through some physical process you can have the waves preferentially going one direction. A good example of this would be when you're driving along at driving into the sun, the light coming off the hood of the car and off the roadway is glare coming up your eyes, very difficult to see where you're going. But that light is partially polarized. So if you have Polaroid sunglasses, which I always drive with, you've got special filters that are polarized the other direction, and they block out most of that glare. Fishing glasses work the same way. Now, you can polarize radiation several different ways, and you can have different mechanisms that do that, and each mechanism is going to do a kind of unique sort of fingerprint, as it were, on the type of polarization you're seeing. So according to the theory, if you had inflation occurring in the early universe, then it should have left an imprint on this background radiation of a certain type of polarization, or a range of different types of polarization. And so what they've done is they've taken these telescopes examining the microwave background, looking for this polarization. Now, the problem is that other mechanisms other than inflation could cause the polarization that you're seeing. And so what they're trying to do in their cosmological models and with their data is trying to sort out how likely this came from a source called inflation or some other source. And I found some of the wording in the paper very interesting from the abstract. They were talking here about their data, and it said, I'm looking for it right here. They said that we find that our results are inconsistent with the null hypothesis at a significance of more than 5 sigma. Now, that loses people, I know, but when you're talking about sigmas, you're talking about a statistical argument and how likely or how confident you are in your result. When they mentioned the null hypothesis, they meant not finding evidence of inflation in the polarization in the background radiation. So what they've done is they've eliminated the null hypothesis in their data with what they think is a high level of confidence. And they also said later on in the paper that this is a quote, more or less, non-detection of that back non-detection of the polarization due to inflation is disfavored by 5.9 sigma. In other words, they're putting forth a statistical argument ruling out not seeing evidence for inflation.
Does that mean, with only about 30 seconds here, and essentially, and they're being honest, at least in the language of physics, and it sounds like discrete math and all sorts of other things, that they're admitting that they've stacked the deck in terms of their evidence and their results?
I think so. And I think, as I say, it's a bit premature. A good friend of mine said it means that they most likely did not detect nothing. That's what they're basically saying. So it's really bizarre argument to make, and most people on the street would find this bizarre. Only among sophisticated scientist types would this be a compelling case.
Danny Faulkner is our guest. He has a PhD in astronomy from Indiana University. He's professor of astronomy for Answers in Genesis and author of an article titled Big Bang, the Evolution of a Theory. I strongly recommend you read it. It'll help you make sense of some of the latest claims made about a reported breakthrough in the Big Bang Theory, and you'll find it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this reported breakthrough in the Big Bang Theory and inflation, and then we will be reviewing episode 2 of Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. I invite your questions and your comments on this Tuesday afternoon, March the 18th. We are coming to you live, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. When we come back, after kind of cutting through all of the sophisticated language of the latest research into inflation, what it sounds like to me, dealing with it from a layperson's standpoint, is that this theory, the Big Bang Theory, had such a remarkable inconsistency, they had to invent an idea that they hope, they're praying, they found evidence for. We'll be right back. Einstein and astrology, it all started with the Big Bang.
Talk radio for the Christian worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you looking for a Lutheran elementary school that uses the principles of classical education? A school where students enjoy a solid and Christ-centered academic environment, including classes such as Latin, world history, and classical literature? Trinity St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel and Warden, Illinois is the school for your student. We're located just 30 miles northeast of St. Louis. TSPLutheranSchool.org or 618-633-2202.
How would you like to attend a conference and hear Matt Harrison, Craig Parton, Jonathan Fisk, Will Wheaton, Chris Roseborough, and Al Schmidt? You're invited to the 2014 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. Registration is $100 per person. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org.
What this telescope does is it measures the cosmic microwave background radiation. That's the oldest light in the universe. It was emitted 380,000 years after the Big Bang, when the universe was in a hot, dense, early state. And BICEP-2 is designed to search for patterns of polarization in that light. In particular, BICEP-2 is looking for swirling components to those patterns called B-modes. The theory of cosmic inflation, which attempts to explain the start of the Big Bang itself, predicts that the early universe will contain a background of gravitational waves that produce such a swirling B-mode pattern of polarization. And today we're going to be reporting the detection of B-mode polarization as seen by the BICEP-2 telescope that matches very closely the predicted pattern.
This is John Kovac. He's principal investigator of BICEP-2, a telescope that has been taking measurements of the cosmic background radiation at the South Pole, part of the center of this reported breakthrough in the Big Bang Theory from researchers. He's from Harvard University. We're talking with Dr. Danny Faulkner about this breakthrough in the Big Bang Theory, and then a little bit later we will review episode 2 of Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. Dr. Faulkner, I'm going to back up again and see if I can both understand and explain this in the simplest possible terms. As astronomers and physicists and cosmologists look out into the universe, they see this background radiation. It's remarkably uniform in its temperature. It's very low, but it's remarkably uniform. And they ask the question, if the universe is indeed as big and as old as we believe it is, how did it become so uniform? How did one point in space communicate or exchange information with another point in space, since they were never, ever in the history of the universe close enough together to exchange any kind of thermal information, to, achieve...
Thermal equilibrium.
Equilibrium. That was the term I was looking for. Okay. And so there's not enough time in the history of the universe, according to their model, for that to have taken place because radiation has to travel at the speed of light. They come up with this idea of saying there was a time when these points in space were close enough together to exchange information. Then this uncaused, rapid, faster than the speed of light, expansion of the universe and space-time began to occur, giving us the great expanse of the cosmos we have and explaining why all that background radiation is the same.
That's very well said. In fact, I like your explanation better than mine.
Well, you have all the scientific jargon behind yours. One thing I'm wondering about, they're also making this claim that we can look back to the beginning of time. And I'm a little concerned about that, because isn't that background radiation that they can detect in every direction in the universe as we observe it really not the beginning of time, but like, I don't know, 400,000 years after the Big Bang?
You've got that correct. There's a lot of sloppy language used in all of this. According to the theory, the background radiation dates from a time a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, 400,000 years. So we're not seeing back to the very beginning, as they claim. But they would argue that since inflation happened in the first tiny fraction of a second of the universe, and that inflation, evidence of it, was imprinted into the universe, then in that sense, they're kind of looking back to the beginning. That is a subtle point, and so the statement we're saying back to the beginning is not exactly true.
Is there any physics known to us now that even attempts to explain this expansion?
That's a good point. I was going to make that earlier and didn't have the time. No known physics in the sense of being tested. If you really look in the literature, you'll find that there have been many suggestions as to what caused inflation. Some sort of field is the big thing there. But it's all theoretical physics. There's not a scintilla of evidence to support it. So if you like a lot of theoretical physics with no evidence, there's plenty of physics to explain it. Take your choice. But if you want to talk about really tested physics, there is nothing out there. It's still a big mystery. This thing must have happened, and we've got all these ideas how it might have happened, but absolutely no clear indication of what actually did happen.
I think inflation is probably the biggest stopgap measure that the theorists have kind of tossed in to prop up the model. Are there others?
Oh, yeah. This is definitely a rescuing device, but the biggie. You know what I've seen over the years? I've seen over the past three decades a tremendous amount of alteration made to the model. Not only do they have inflation thrown in, but you have dark matter that's now being invoked. It wasn't invoked 30 years ago. You have dark energy that they've been talking about now for about 15 years, a very idea that was verboten for years. And you've thrown in... string theory, it's another one. That's a theoretical idea in particle physics, and there's no evidence for it either, but yet it's invoked in the early Big Bang model. There are several other factors thrown in, and none of these things were even talked about in cosmological models, say in 1980. The Big Bang of today bears almost no resemblance to the model of 1980, so they keep adding all sorts of things. It kind of reminds me of the old Ptolemaic model with all these epicycles used to explain the positions of the planets. You can make it work, but is it reality? And I'm beginning to see a parallel here. They just keep adding things and adding things. It's very ad hoc. It's in all these rescuing devices to keep the model going.
I mean, speaking of dark energy and dark matter, they are by definition entities that cannot be detected, aren't they?
Well, not directly. Dark matter, we have two lines of evidence really going back to the 1930s that have nothing to do with cosmology, really. And I think there's a good case to make, but the thing is, we don't know what dark matter is. We know what it isn't, and it seems to be that there's no place in our current understanding of particle physics of matter to put it. It's a totally foreign, unknown type of matter, and again, that's another one of those free parameters. Once you think that dark matter may exist from other lines of evidence, then you just start playing with it in your models to get it to fit. And so now that they've said what percentage of the universe is dark matter, that's coming from the models, cosmological models. It's not really coming from a clear measurement, I don't think, independent of the model. And then as far as dark energy is concerned, that's a way they used of describing what they think is an accelerating expansion of the universe. It's getting faster than it was in the past. And that's being driven by looking at what we call type 1A supernovae. These are large explosions that we think we know how bright they are, and there's an indication of an acceleration in the universe. But once you get that, you can then fold that into the model, and that becomes another free parameter. So dark energy and dark matter, there's actually some evidence for that, but I don't like the way they've manipulated it in cosmology.
Well, one other question on this, and then I'd like to talk a little bit about the second episode of Cosmos, the Space-Time Odyssey with you. The theory, as you say, has kind of taken on that quality of the very early theories, medieval theories of our solar system, that, as you say, the model worked, but it was so ridiculously complex and eventually had so many ornaments hanging on it to keep it working, so many counterbalances, that eventually it was scrapped. Do you think it's even possible at this point in astrophysics and cosmology for them to abandon the theory of the Big Bang?
At this point, no. What you need is another possible model. Once you saw the Ptolemaic model didn't work, then the heliocentric model was sitting there the whole time, and suddenly people moved over to it where they hadn't before. But right now, there's really nothing out there, and so you would have to have some other model come forward that people could run to. But I think eventually it will happen, but it's just a matter of how long it will be. I may not live to see that day.
The halls of extinction are a new element of the series that we didn't have in the original. I wanted a place where we could feel the tragedy and the meaning of the end of a species.
The halls of extinction is one of the coolest sequences that appears in three episodes of this Cosmos. And it's just such a great concept, the idea of a museum filled with dioramas of the five great extinction events that hit this planet. But creating it was extremely challenging because it doesn't exist. So we have a digital Halls of Extinction.
We shot plates of Neil walking through sparsely decorated sets. The idea was that they were meant to be these walkways going off from the atrium, and then from these walkways he would go into the different dioramas that show extinction events in the past. So most of that is being created in CGI by talented artists.
If you look at the fossil record, there have been five such catastrophic extinction episodes in the history of the Earth. We have some ideas of how those extinctions occurred. At least one of them was a catastrophic impact of an asteroid. That's the famous one. But we don't know what caused them all. That leaves us susceptible to being blindsided by another extinction period.
There's an unnamed corridor, a sixth corridor beyond the mass extinction events in the Halls of Extinction. And there's no name on that corridor yet. And that's the part of the hope of Cosmos. We can solve our problems. We can use our intelligence to find a pathway to the future.
Some of the contributors of the Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey series, talking about last night's episode and some of the, CGI tricks, could we call it that, that they used to convey some of the information in the episode of Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. Dr. Danny Faulkner is our guest. Dr. Faulkner, our listeners, what would they have seen last night? What was the episode about? What would they have seen in episode 2 of Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey?
Well, it wasn't a lot of astronomy, and there wasn't a lot of science there. It was talking about biological evolution. They talked about the so-called tree of life, but they also talked about in the context of what they called mass extinctions. According to the way they've put together the history of the world, they think over the past 600 million years or so, there have been, half a billion years or so, there's been five huge mass extinctions. People are most familiar with the Cretaceous one that supposedly wiped out the dinosaurs, but there are four others preceding that. And that's generally considered by biologists and geologists to be the great driver of evolution. You wipe out a bunch of species, and it gives an opportunity for these new types of animals to rise. The one that wiped out the dinosaurs supposedly allowed mammals to rise, and that then opened the door for primates and then people. So we can thank that asteroid that destroyed the dinosaurs 65 million years ago for our existence.
One of the features of the series, the episode on Sunday night, was the host kind of sitting by a campfire, and he's explaining to everyone how the wolf became the dog, this kind of notion. And it's interesting to me that he chooses one of the shortest lines in natural selection to try and prove and explain the infinitely long lines of natural selection that evolution suggests.
Yeah, you know what the irony there is that we creationists don't believe much terribly different from what he was saying there. We would just say it quite differently. Look, existing dogs can all interbreed with one another, and they can all interbreed with wolves. So it's obvious that wolves and dogs are all part of the same kind. You know, we think biblically there was a pair of dog kinds on the ark. What it looked like, I haven't a clue, but living dogs and wolves and maybe a few other types of related animals all descended from that original pair on the ark. And, you know, he was talking this plausibility argument of how that had the campfire and a few of the wolves, because of a genetic mutation, had a little less fear of people and came up. And, you know, it's presented in such a way that that seems like truth to Neil deGrasse Tyson and probably many people watching the show. But that's just a story someone has created of what might have happened. You can certainly create a number of other stories to examine this as well. But again, the whole point is we all believe that dogs and wolves are related and descended from a common ancestor. And here's the kicker. What did he start with? He started with a wolf-type animal, and what did you end up with? A wolf-type animal. That's hardly evolution. It's a type of selection, be it artificial or natural. It's selection, but within a kind. So by doing that, he didn't really demonstrate evolution as we know it, as you go from one kind of animal to another. He did a similar thing with the big bears, the brown bears. He talked about how polar bears may have evolved, quote-unquote. But the problem is polar bears and brown bears can interbreed. They generally don't because they don't live in the same places. But in the last 2 years, I've read about a bear that was killed in the wild. It looked kind of strange. They did genetic testing, and sure enough, they found out one parent was a polar bear and one parent was a grizzly or a Kodiak. I'm not sure which one now. But apparently they're all fertile, interbreed. They're all the same kind, and so you start with bears, and you end up with bears. You've not really evolved anything once again. It's this huge gimme that you take this small variation within a kind and extrapolate that over countless generations to get something else, but that's not demonstrated. There's no evidence for this. This is simply a conjecture that's taken place.
Dr. Danny Faulkner is our guest. He holds a PhD in astronomy from Indiana University. He's professor of astronomy for Answers in Genesis, author of an article titled Big Bang, The Evolution of a Theory. We're reviewing episode 2 of Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned.
Check out the updated showroom at Valo Floor Coverings, 1009 Plummer Drive in Edwardsville. Valo's offers free in-home measurement, interior design consultation, and experienced installation. Celebrating 50 years of trusted experience, Valo Floor Coverings, 1009 Plummer Drive in Edwardsville, 618-656-7788 or valofloor.com.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
You believe that there's not one error in the Bible. That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line. Available 24/7. 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
That first presentation will be on how lawyers look at making the case for the reliability of the New Testament.
Craig Parton talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
The information we have about Jesus, primarily about his life and death and resurrection, primarily comes from the four Gospels, certainly from the rest of the New Testament. But if the record we have of Jesus Christ can't be relied on, we're doomed.
You can meet and hear Craig Parton making the case for the historical Jesus June 13th and 14th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, just look for the Making the Case logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. Danny Faulkner is our guest. We're reviewing Episode 2 of Cosmos, a space-time odyssey. In about 10 minutes, Pastor Scott Stiegemeyer will be with us. We'll continue a series with him on God's gift of marriage today, Myths About Cohabitation. Dr. Faulkner, another thing that was featured in the Sunday night episode of Cosmos, a space-time odyssey, was a concept called abiogenesis. What is it?
Abiogenesis is the belief that life can arise from non-living things.
Okay, that I thought was pretty much refuted at the dawn of science.
I think so. I mean, there were a bunch of experiments done starting in the 1600s that continued right into the 1800s that should have proven beyond many doubt that biogenesis is true, that life begets life. Only living things give rise to living things. In fact, if you want to talk about observational science, you want to talk about science backed up by data, the law of biogenesis, it seems to be well established. And the prospect of abiogenesis doesn't appear to be true. But yet, we're right back to that now with the people thinking that somehow, somewhere, sometime, someplace, life arose out of non-living stuff. That's a very basic part of biological evolution.
So, essentially, something that has never been observed has been repeatedly, in very simple experiments, but repeatedly demonstrated not to occur. Not to occur. The host of Cosmos is telling us, did occur, and occurred over and over and over and over and over again in order to bring about life on Earth and elsewhere.
And they say we're not very scientific. I mean, that's just an unscientific statement on its face. But yet, if you reject the possibility of a creator, then that's the only possibility you have. There must have been abiogenesis that took place at some point. And again, you made the case very clear there that this is contrary to good science. This is fancy. This is fiction. This is wishful thinking that life can come from non-living things.
Is that ever addressed in the Cosmos? In the course of the episode of Cosmos, saying, now look, we know that this is kind of a tricky subject, but we do believe that for some reason, in a way that we cannot explain, cannot observe, and has been demonstrated never to have happened in our observation, it did happen.
He kind of made a backhanded allusion to that. It may have been in the first episode last week, but he at one point said that the origin of life is one of the greatest mysteries of science. So, I mean, that's a backhanded way of admitting that we don't know how it could have happened. We don't observe it happening, but it must have happened, and we're still working on that. That's where the wishful thinking comes in.
What else would we have seen on Sunday night in the second episode of Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey?
Well, he talked about the tree of life. He showed these different creatures all over the place, almost like ornaments or different leaves stashed here and there. And the problem is we don't observe those transitions. We see the tree only exists in textbooks and on TV shows. It doesn't exist in the real world. People have taken different creatures and tried to assemble them certain ways. A good example showing that that's what's going on is if you look up anywhere, they didn't talk about this, but if you look it up in a lot of places, the lineage of man, you got all these other creatures out there that are presumed to be some sort of intermediate form between apes and people, and they can't agree where to put them. You know, Neanderthals. Right now, people are thinking it's a dead end. It was a parallel to us, but in the past, people thought they were our ancestors. What do you do with Australopithecines? Where do you put those? If this were a well-established science, there would be very little debate over the thing. But there are people who passionately argue how to arrange human lineage, and the same thing happens with other creatures. You know, where did birds come from? Some people say they came from dinosaurs. Some people say dinosaurs came from birds. Well, they both can't be right. So again, those branches on that tree of life are not there. It's the twigs, the ends of the branches, and all the branches have been filled in theoretically.
Now, there was also some speculation about how life must have, might have, probably did evolve elsewhere in the universe. And I got a question for you on that, because often what we find is people who I do not believe that, you know, an astronomer necessarily knows anything about biology, but it seems as though astronomers, cosmologists really want to be able to find life elsewhere in the universe. It seems like all of this is kind of, if we can find it there, then we've proven that we're right about how it happened here.
Yeah, if the Earth is the only place in the universe where life exists, then that makes the Earth really special. They talk about, you know, how big the universe is, how many planets there might be, and so forth. But if we're the only place where life exists, then that makes the Earth so special, it brings in the possibility of creation. So if you're an evolutionist, you have to believe that life has arisen again and again and again. It's just one of those things that happens when the conditions are right. So that's the real thing driving the search for extrasolar planets, that is, planets around other stars, driving the search for possibility of life in the past on Mars, maybe on some of the satellites of the outer planets. Those are the stakes. It's based upon the assumption of evolution.
I mean, a lot of this. I mean, how many missions are being funded either by governments or by private enterprises into space in order to search for, ultimately, let's say, we're trying to look for water on Mars. But that is one step in trying to locate the remnants or the evidence of past life on Mars, isn't it?
Yes. Right now, nobody believes there's life on Mars, but we do know that Mars in the past was wetter and warmer than it is today. It had bodies of water, so it had a thicker atmosphere, and people are thinking that maybe for a half billion years, conditions for life were conducive on Mars, and life might have evolved there. So if we go there, we might find fossils or other evidence that life was once abundant on the surface.
And there's one other term that you need to, and I'm probably mispronouncing it, tardigrade. What's that term that our listeners would have seen Sunday night in the episode of Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey?
Tardigrade, is that little creature that he was talking about?
I believe so.
Yeah, it's a little creature. I don't know much about it. You'd be better off asking a biologist. It looked like a little mole swimming around. And he pointed out how tiny it was. You know, it's a little speck that you might, look like a dot. With keen eyesight, you might actually see the thing, but you'd have to magnify it. And his point of that was that this little thing had evolved, you know, like a half billion years ago or so, and it survived all five of those big impacts or those big events that caused mass extinction. And it was just he was wondering about this little thing, how it managed to survive every one of those major disasters, while trilobites didn't and while dinosaurs didn't and so forth. And I'm not quite sure what the point was other than the fact that it was a survivor of some sort.
Dr. Danny Faulkner holds a PhD in astronomy from Indiana University. He's professor of astronomy for Answers in Genesis and he's author of an article titled Big Bang, The Evolution of a Theory. I highly recommend you read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Faulkner, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Faulkner will join us on Tuesdays to review Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, as long as the miniseries runs. Folks, if you appreciate our timely responses to TV series like Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, please consider making a tax-deductible gift to support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. You can make a secure online contribution at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make that check payable to Issues, etc. and send it to Issues, etc., Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Here's the address again. Issues, etc., Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and as always, thanks for your support. When we come back, we're going to continue our series on God's gift of marriage with Pastor Scott Stiegemeyer, author of the Issues, etc., Book of the Month for March, Your Marriage by God's Design. We'll be talking about several myths about cohabitation. Stay tuned.
In Higher Things, we believe that if you put good Christ crucified for you Lutheranism into a youth, you'll get a good Christ crucified for you Lutheran youth. Join us this July at the Higher Things Crucified Youth Conferences in Florida, Wisconsin, Utah. Check us out at www.higherthings.org. Higherthings.org. Dare your youth to be Lutherans this summer.
Where do we find Jesus in the book of Job? I've written an article in the latest Issues, etc. journal titled Job in Four Not-So-Easy Steps. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues, etc. journal. Just look for the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. Pastor Ross Johnson has written our Wittenberg Trail feature. It's titled Lutheranism, Christianity's Best-Kept Secret, the free online Issues, etc. journal.
Does your church need a backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
No gimmicks, no shticks, just straightforward preaching and teaching in accord with Scripture and the Lutheran confessions. By the book liturgy, right from the hymnal. No glitz, just Christ crucified for sinners like us. We're Grace Lutheran Church in Racine, Wisconsin. Come receive God's gifts with us. Find out more about us at gracelutheranracine, that's all one word, .net. And like you, we're proud supporters of Issues, etc.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you have a student finishing up 8th grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues, Etc. journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues, Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues, Etc. journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues, Etc.